Welcome to the Archive Room podcast, stories of Manx life in years gone by, told by the people who were there. Manx Radio. Fastamai, I'm Judith Leigh, and I'm very pleased to find you waiting for me at the door to the Archive Room, the place where we keep stories of island life in years gone by, told by the people who were there. So come on in, sit down and make yourself comfortable, and let's listen to this week's selection. We're in holiday mood in the Archive Room tonight with stories of two very different Douglas neighbours who I think could both rightly be called pioneers in the island's tourist industry. One is the Falcon Cliff Hotel, the other is Cunningham's Camp. And in 1990, David Collister asked Jack Niverson, a member of the tourist board for some 20 years, to tell him the story of the holiday success that didn't actually start out as a business at all.
The first camp was at Gwawdl. It was known as the Housetrek Camp. And it was set up by Joseph Cunningham, who was the father of camping as we know it throughout the world. Billy Butlin only started some 40 years after Joseph Cunningham had been going. And he was bringing over certain people to the Isle of Man. In the early stages, they were kind of charitable and benevolent people that were looking after youngsters, perhaps, who had done something wrong, and they were taking them over a holiday and trying to improve them. And Joseph Cunningham set up this camp, and he thought it was an idea to turn it into a business, set it up commercially and advertised it throughout Britain. On your application form, you had to sign the pledge.
Did you?
An essential that no alcohol should be consumed, not only on the premises, but whilst they were on holiday in the Isle of Man during this period. And it was for boys only, of course. But Joseph Cunningham ran this camp, eventually went to Little Switzerland, and he set up there, and they were largely tented in the early stages. And as I said, he accommodated something like 60,000 young people during the season. And these were provided with concerts and dancing and tennis and swimming and all the rest of it. And not once during the whole of that time did they have to call the police in for any trouble.
So there was a rigid regime then to make sure that they didn't drink.
Yes, indeed. Yes, they stopped them, and people could be sent home if they were found to have drink. And another thing, too, the place was well policed during the night. And the lights went out at 11:45 every night, apart from Sunday. They went out at 10:30 then. And lo and behold, any of them that were out and about after that time, they were giving their marching orders. These tents were the bell tent with the pole up the middle, and in busy times they would have 8 in one of these tents, all their feet going towards the centre. They had boards underneath them, and they had a mattress. And the only other furniture that was in the whole place was a small mirror on the centre pole, you see, so that they could have a look at themselves when they got up in the morning. They had latrines in a special place, you see, which were kept spotlessly clean and so forth. And the place was very well run and very well kept. The entrance was quite a beautiful entrance. They had what they call a fernery there, with lots of ferns and so forth. And the general public were invited on certain days of the week to come and inspect and walk right through the camp. A lot of people used to go regularly to the Sunday concerts. They had an orchestra playing at every meal. It was the largest dining room in the Isle of Man.
So they'd cater for how many at a time? I mean, in a week, presumably, they'd have thousands of people, would they?
Oh, yes. At any one time, they could go up to 4,000. And most of the staff, they were dual-purpose staff. They were painters, perhaps, in the wintertime, or plumbers and all the rest of it. And they put aprons on them and little dicky bows on them in the summertime, and they waited on the tables.
Some of them were also musicians, were they?
Yes, indeed. Yes, one of the greatest acts they had in the Cunningham's camp were the Horbury brothers. Well, they weren't brothers, actually. It was grandson, father, and grandfather. And they used to play concertinas, these ones. They used to swing round in the air, and they'd play all sorts of wonderful melodies. And they got a great reception. Now, in the winter time, of course, there was no need for them. They used to come to church for fairs in the Isle of Man. Many people will remember them.
Now, what about girls? They didn't have girls at all then?
No, it was for young men. This camp was for young men. They didn't have girls, and they didn't have bars and drink.
But when these lads left the camp to go into the town, then there'd be girls looking to them, maybe, and a few drinks taken then, surely.
Well, I don't know about the drinks, but they seemed to behave themselves in the town. They would go around the town in numbers, linked up together, like arm in arm, six or up to a dozen of them, walking along on the promenade, and they would encircle a couple of girls that were coming along and have a little bit of fun with them and all the rest of it. And it might then mean an introduction to one another. But generally speaking, they were very well behaved. No trouble. People would send their young sons over to the Isle of Man, staying at Cunningham's camp, and they knew they'd have a jolly good time, and they knew they had to behave themselves. It was very cheap, too. It was 2 guineas a week. This was all found, 2 guineas. This was for their bed, for their meals, which were very enjoyable and very good. They used to have some jokes about it, you see. They were very fond of ham, you see, the sliced ham. And the boys used to sing, "What did we have for supper last night? Cunning ham," they used to say. "What did we have for dinner? Cunning ham," and so forth. It became very profitable. In the early stages, it was very hard going. But subsequently, there were profits announced in the 30s and so forth. Something like 37,000 a year they were making. Enormous money in those days, you see. As the years went by, they had less and less of the tents and more chalets and the accommodation in apartments, in the buildings as they built them along. This continued right until 1939, and the camp was subsequently taken over by the Admiralty, and in 1945, it was subsequently sold then to the Douglas Camp, Young Men's Camp. Yeah. The Cunninghams ceased to have any interest in it. And most people that worked at the camp have very happy memories of working. They tell some funny stories, but they're very happy memories of working there.
Jack Niverson, former tourist board member, talking with David Collister about Cunningham's Camp. When the camp moved from Groudel to Little Switzerland, its near neighbour was the Falcon Cliff Hotel. And as Eva Kane tells the story of another pioneer in the tourist trade, listen carefully for what she has to say about girls and alcohol and the young men from Cunningham's camp. Eva Kane had a very successful career as an entertainer on stage and screen.
I'm looking at the Roy Hudd's Cavalcade of Variety Acts, and on page 92, under the letter K, it says Eva Kane, Siffleuse, Lady Whistler and Soprano, born Isle of Man 1923, and apart from a most melodious whistling routine of pop, she would then break into a coloratura vocal and usually stop the show. Her act was one of the first to be televised after the Second World War. Her family owned hotels on the Isle of Man, where I believe she retired.
But it's not actually Eva's show business career that we're talking about now, but rather the work of her parents, as she now explains to David Collister. Eva was born in 1923, but the story she now tells begins in 1919, when her parents became the owners of the Falcon Cliff Hotel.
Your mother was Ellen, was she? Ellen Kane?
Yes, she was Ellen Kane, but in the hotel business she became known as Caney, and nobody called her anything else.
And your father was Leo?
My father was Leo. My father had been away during the war years. He was in the RASC. And he had been sent out to Africa, and he actually got lost there. Through illness, his papers went missing. He had smallpox, and he was being nursed by the natives, and all his paperwork had been lost. And mother, in the meantime, was managing a big estate down in Fairbourne for Sir Peter Peacock, who was the man who started the Peacock's stores. We now have one over here, which is rather strange. Sir Peter and Mother came over to the island to have a look at two hotels which Mother wanted to have. Mm. It was either Falcon Cliff or the Colby Glen, and she decided on Falcon Cliff, which was known not as a white castle, but a white elephant. Nobody had ever been able to make it pay. It was because you couldn't get to it. You had to walk up Palace Road to get on the one side, or on the other side, you had to walk up well over 100 steps up the side of the cliff.
Yes.
Mother and Dad had been in there from 1919, but it certainly wasn't paying because of the difficulty to get to it.
It was much easier for the holidaymakers to stay down on the promenade.
Much easier, yes. Yeah. The only ones we did get were the boys coming from Cunningham's camp, who used to bring the girls from the promenade up to Cunningham's camp for the dance in the morning. And when it came up to lunchtime, the boys were taking the girls back down the steps to the boarding houses on the promenade for lunch.
Yeah.
And so they came through the hotel and had a beer on the way, which they weren't allowed to have up in Cunningham's camp, of course.
Yes. But it must have been your parents then that organised the Falcon Cliff lift?
Yes. My mother decided that we must have some sort of means of getting the people up to us, and it turned out to be this Wadsworth's lift. A man from Croydon came over to build the lift, which is classed as a railway because it has a track to it. And from then on, the hotel started to pay, mainly because there was a novelty of getting up and down to the hotel by the lift. And also, my mother wrote during the winter months to 13 different TT Riders companies.
Mm-hmm.
And she got 13 replies and 13 bookings. And that started off big clientele for the TT races every year for the Manx Grand Prix.
She was a woman of foresight who realised that something had to be done to make this place pay then.
Yes. She was a very good businesswoman.
How much would they have paid for it in 1919, do you know?
It was somewhere around about £250,
really?
Something as silly as that, because it didn't pay.
Yeah.
You know, it was, as I say, a white elephant and not a white hotel.
She was determined to make it pay.
Yes, she was a very determined lady.
So here we come to the time that you were born, in 1923, and that would be when they were still in Falcon Cliff?
Oh, yes, yes. That was when it was beginning to pick up.
What are your first memories of it then?
Standing on the terrace, dressed in a little black bathing costume, and I spent the entire summer months on the terrace and finished up nearly as black sunburned as my swimsuit.
We were told there were endless hot summer days in those days.
Oh, wonderful. You started it at Easter and it went on really until the end of September. It was all summer.
Were they really like that?
They were. They were really and truly wonderful summers.
So you'd have gone to your first school from there, did you?
No, I didn't go to school. I had a governess. The school board man, as he was known in those days, caught up with me when I was about 5 and a half and came up to Falcon Cliff and said to my mother, this child should be at school. And my mother said, well, I'm not sending her to school. I'm going to get her a governess, which she did. And the governess started in the September, October. She decided to go home for her Christmas to see her sister. And during the time that she was home, the sister committed suicide.
Oh.
And my governess, being so upset about this, also committed suicide.
Oh. So did you get another governess then?
I did. We had a lady who was a good customer of ours at Falcon Cliff, and she had been a teacher at St. Mary's for many years. Her husband was a seagoing captain. And when she retired from St. Mary's, she took me on as a pupil.
Mm.
And so I stayed on with Mrs. Edwards, as her name was, until I was nearly 12 years of age.
Yeah.
She only taught certain subjects, of course. And one of them, she got me very interested in learning Shakespeare. And that was really how I got my first taste of
the drama world.
Life
yes.
and the drama world.
Yeah. So here we are then, running up in the years towards the Second World War. What was happening in those years? Did you have to work in the hotel?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yes. I was working from when I was 13. I had to work before. I mean, there were many times that I was sent to go down the lift and bring the people up in the lift and general runabout in the hotel.
Yeah.
The grounds of the hotel On the opposite side of the road, of Palace Road, there were big tennis courts and putting greens, which had been bought by my uncle, and it was run in conjunction with the hotel.
Oh, right.
So many times I was sent over to take the money for the tennis courts or to serve the ice creams or that sort of thing on the sports grounds.
So you had a lot of work to do during the summer then?
Oh, yes, yes. Had to work all year round in the winter. I was set on with a paintbrush and a can of paint. We did all our own decorating because in those days you couldn't afford to pay decorators. You had to do it yourself.
Well, then we're coming towards the Second World War. The threat of war was coming in. The hoteliers must have known this. They must have known that their living was under threat.
Well, we knew because we had five officers came over to stay at Falconcliff in the March of 1939. They were all in mufti, so of course we didn't know who they were at first. And they were here to take over Cunningham's camp to become a naval establishment. And because we were adjacent to Cunningham's, we were taken over for the officers, and we were told that in the event of war being declared, we must empty the hotel within 24 hours. And within 24 hours, the ships came into the bay with the naval officers and the little boys for HMS St. George, as Cunningham's camp became.
Yeah.
The hotel was commandeered by the Navy, but we were allowed to keep the bars open, but we weren't allowed to take civilian visitors.
So what sort of money would they pay you then? Was it equivalent to what you'd have been paid during the holiday period?
Nothing like, no. The holiday makers would be paying 8 and 6, 9 and 6, and 10 and 6. And that was for your room, breakfast, lunch, afternoon tea, late dinner and supper.
Amazing, isn't it?
Ridiculous, isn't it?
So they didn't pay anything like that, the services?
No, it was. They started off somewhere around about 3 and 6 pence for each officer, which was stupid. And by the end of the first year, so many of the wives had been brought over and the officers had gone out into their own homes with their wives. And we were trying to keep the hotel open for about 7 or 8 naval officers. And, of course, we were running at a terrible loss. So Mother decided one day that enough was enough. She put on her best smile and her best mood, and up she went to Cunningham's camp to see Captain Duke, who was in charge there, to tell him that we were closing the hotel down. And he said, oh, you can't do that. You've got our officers in there. So Mother said, nothing in the world can make me stay open to run at a loss for 5 or 6 officers. I'm very sorry, but you must allow us to take other people in. So very grudgingly, he gave us notice that we could take other people in. And the first lot of people that we took in were the officers who were in charge of the internment camps. And we had their headquarters staff and had to provide a second mess for them because the Navy and the Army couldn't work together.
No.
They had to be separate. And that went on for several months until one day my mother said, enough is enough and we are closing this down. Mm-hmm. And the Army officers that we had with us took it over, requisitioned it to become an internee hospital.
Eva and her parents then moved to Mannin in Marathon Road in Douglas, but it wasn't long before they took over the House Drake, the Golf Links Hotel, and survived the war years with a mixture of army officers and permanent guests, mostly from the Channel Islands.
A little bit later on, I joined the Red Cross and did part-time nursing at the Majestic Hotel, which was by this time an army RAMC hospital for the soldiers on the island.
Yes.
And I worked there as a nurse.
Presumably you still had to help your mother and father at House Drake, did you?
Oh, yes. I worked in the hotel in between times, and together with one or two other girls, Beryl Hardy, as she was then, was another person who helped to teach the little sailor boys. In the palace ballroom, we ran a little dancing school there to teach the boys how to dance.
Mm.
So we all had many different jobs that we did during the war.
Yeah.
But it was all pretty well war work.
And what happened to the Kane family after the war years will be for us to find out in another visit to the archive room. But I think we've time for just one more stop on the tourist trail. In this conversation between Jeff Cannell and Bernie May MHK, recorded in the late 1980s when Bernie was the island's Minister for Industry, he reflects on the famous Derby Castle.
Oh, yes, the Derby Castle in the old days was probably the inn place in the Isle of Man. You know, they had a theatre, the ballroom, there was the hotel which my family ran in those days. The ballroom had 7 bars in, incidentally, and I think there's a lot of people who will still remember with fond memories the old Melier days of the Derby Castle era, which really, I think, led to the current spate of Meliers that run throughout the pubs in the island today.
Well, of course, we think of the Palace Lido ballroom, the biggest in Europe, as they say, but the Derby Castle had a fairly big ballroom as well, didn't it?
The whole complex was a good size. Theatre was one of the old Victorian theatres, and they had the most beautiful gardens running up through towards the ballroom and to the hotel complex.
The glass-covered walkway.
With a glass-covered veranda, that's right.
The theatre and the ballroom and the pub, it was quite the big centre at the end of the promenade, wasn't it?
Oh, that's right. You know, I suppose you could compare it really on a smaller scale with the type of operation that's at the Winter Gardens in Blackpool. It had all sorts of amenities under one roof.
And the acts that were on at the theatre were top class, really, at the time.
There were some super acts there in the late 50s and early 60s. Janet Brown, for example, was a regular visitor there. Ken Dodd, I think, started his professional career in the Derby Castle, and he used to come season after season. The first season he appeared there, he was a bottom of the bill artist, and he came back season after season until he reached national status.
I remember Leslie Welsh, the memory man there.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Standing
right
up and asking questions about the TD, and he got them all, of course. And another thing, Bernie, which you might remember, that the original five-a-side football was in the Derby Castle at Easter, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. There was wrestling in the ballroom there, and they did have the first five-a-side matches in there. I think later it transferred to the Palace Ballroom, but it started its days in the Derby Castle. I think a popular trip in those days, they could go into the Derby Castle, see a show there, then afterwards they could come out, get the tram for a couple of coppers, and they'd be up at the White City. And we remember the things that used to be up there. There was the roller coaster, and Joseph Carmer, he started his career up in the Onkenhead Pavilion. Joseph was up there for many years, and he was a most popular attraction there, and I think prior to him they had Berto Rosselli. Berto Rosselli was an illusionist. The thing that he used to specialise in was catching a live bullet in his teeth. And a good friend of ours, a member of the local rifle clubs, Tony Osborne, used to be the chap who fired the rifle from the back of the theatre. And Tony would never tell anyone how it was done. Nobody ever understood how it was done. People used to flock up there, the electric trams would be full, taking people up, they'd be queuing to get in, and night after night they'd go and see this marvel of Berto Rosselli just catching the bullet with his teeth.
In the end, I think I'm right in saying the Onkenhead Pavilion burned down, didn't it?
Yeah, it did one night, and I think that was when the pavilion burnt down that Joseph Carmer transferred his act then down to the Derby Castle.
Also going at the time was the Crescent Pavilion as well, wasn't it?
Crescent Pavilion with the Stella Hartley concert party and Dave and Joe O'Duffy, who were with her for, I can't remember how many seasons they were there for, but they were there for an awful long time. Yeah.
So when did you leave the Derby Castle?
It was 63, and it was for demolition of. The doors were closed and the last customers went out, and the days of Florrie Ford and many, many other stars of musical and days long past have finally gone.
And let's finish this visit to the archive room by remembering another born entertainer who loved being in the spotlight. Manxman Lawrence Kermode, who died in the summer of 2015 at the age of 100, just months after becoming the oldest person ever to compete and win a class in the Manx Music Festival. A regular competitor in the Guild, Lawrence excelled in reciting from the works of T.E. Brown and in the folk song class. Even his walk up to the stage was an entertainment.
I should have never done that damn parish walk.
Thank you. silly old fool. Trying to sing in the guild. What's he gonna be up to next? God help us. Right, now, this little song that I'm going to sing, there are many variations of it, and it's Cockleton Muscles. So, we'll give it a whirl. In Dublin's fair city, where the girls are so pretty, I first set me eyes on sweet Molly Malone. As she wheeled a wheelbarrow through streets broad and narrow, crying, "Cockles, muscles, alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh," crying, "Cockles, muscles, alive, alive, oh." She died of the fever, and no one could save her, and that was the end of sweet Molly Malone. Now her ghost wheels her barrow through streets broad and narrow, crying, "Cockles, muscles, alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh," crying, "Cockles, muscles, alive, alive, oh." Good am I, you.
Remembering 100-year-old Lawrence Kermode, the oldest person ever to compete and win a class in the Manx Music Festival. And that's where we have to leave this mini-series of visits to the archive room. But I'll be back later this year with more fascinating and funny stories of Ireland life in years gone by, told by the people who were there. But in the meantime, don't forget that the programmes in all previous series of the Archive Room are available as podcasts via manxradio.com or your usual podcast provider. But now it's time for me to return you to the present day. And so, until we meet again, this is Judith saying thank you for listening, and I'm leaving the very last word to Howard Hampton.
So long, yes, sir.
Station.